to the second case this morning, In re Leonard Bronk.
May it please the Court. Mr. Issa. Leonard Bronk is a fine man, an honorable man, and he did the right thing. And let me say that in this context, that he is the epitome of what we like to think of as the greatest generation. He is the honest but unfortunate debtor that qualifies for a discharge in bankruptcy under these facts, and he also may avail himself of the exemptions. What are the facts in this case? They are stipulated. Let me put them in a form that makes sense. The debtor, there was an error in Ms. Bronk's, his wife's, enrollment in a group health plan. She developed cancer, and when she went to the hospital and presented the insurance coverage, it was accepted. It was only after she...
Mr. Redfield, none of this background has anything to do with the legal issues that you're here on. So
thank
you. Maybe
you
could skip to the two contested legal issues in the appeal.
Mr. Bronk suffered a major stroke, and he was left with substantial medical bills. His hope of living a life in his home without government assistance and caring for the education of his grandchildren appeared dashed.
Her bills mounted up, what, a couple hundred thousand or something?
The hospital bills were actually in excess of $400,000.
Okay, and then he has a stroke?
He had a stroke.
Okay.
And
at this point, his house is owned without encumbrance, right?
Exactly. And at this point, the hospital was pursuing this. No judgment was obtained by the hospital with respect to the medical bills. And the case was actually not pursued and was dismissed without prejudice. Mr. Bronk sought legal counsel for what he could do in this situation. And very clear legal advice was given to him. Refinance your house, which was entirely paid for. Put the proceeds into, in this particular case, a college savings plan that amounted to about $95,000. He had $45,000 in a savings account. He took that money and he put it into an annuity. That transaction was challenged by the trustee, and the trustee was saying, and this was the position of the trustee throughout the entire proceedings in the court, in the lower court, in the bankruptcy court, which is when you transfer, when you convert non-exempt assets completely into exempt assets, in this case the retirement annuity and the college savings plan, you have run afoul of first of all the provision that you may not transfer assets to when there is the sense of the fraudulent intent transfer, and this was challenged in the taxpayer or the taxpayer the we relied on the Smiley case. In the Smiley case, the court held that a transfer of these assets under these circumstances, which was pure exemption planning, unless they were had some sort of fraudulent indicia that they qualified for the exemptions. Now, it is significant that Mr. Brock indicate what was found that
He filed for bankruptcy about just 2 or 3 weeks after he made these transfers.
Yes, he did. And the Second Circuit said the conversion of assets, the Seventh Circuit, the conversion of assets from exempt to non-exempt within the preceding year, within the year preceding, does not trigger a fraud, is not fraudulent to taxpayers. Mr. Brock did not attempt to hide or conceal anything from his creditors. He was an elderly man, hoped to preserve a few assets.
Counsel, the discharge question is not here. All we have here is the college savings account exemption question and the annuity exemption question.
In that opinion, the trustee noted that consequently he was entitled to a discharge and his exemption claims will not be denied under 815.18.10. Now, the significance of that is that the trustee never argued that there was a hinder, delay, or defraud of creditors with respect to the exemptions. Therefore, we are arguing that those the transfers to the exemptions is covered only under the arguments made in Brock as to whether the transactions fall within the provisions of the statute. That is, whether they qualify as a college savings plan and whether they qualify as an annuity. That, we say, is the only issue here. There is no issue of a fraudulent intent. Let me say with respect to, first, the college savings plan. The statute is, we think, inordinately clear I would like to say under the opinions of, that we've had two cases on this, Judge Martin's case in the Eastern District and Judge Pepper's case. And the colloquy in front of Judge Martin is interesting. The court asked, is there an interest in the account? This is a college savings account. Yes. And what is exempted by the statute in interest? The trustee said 815.18.3p says an interest in a college savings account under section 1464, and is an interest which Mr. Carl, the debtor, has. Debtor has an interest, but not of the type of interest that's beyond the reach of creditors under 1464. Is 1464 an exemption statute? No, that's the section of the statute that creates the EdVest account. These are the college savings account. So clearly, there is an exemption statute, and there is an exemption statute in which the account owner may avail himself of the exemption.
Now, you're talking about the Wisconsin law.
Exactly.
Yes, and it's different than other states that have a time period when you can do this.
Ah, thank you for raising that. Every single state that has evaluated a college savings plan has provided for an exemption for the account holder, which is the debtor. Everyone has. Now, they may have placed some limitations on the amount that can be contributed to it, or they may impose some time frame as to when it could be, how long it must be left in, but there are none that find that there is an interest, that the exemption is available to a person, that it's always available to the account holder. And the legislative history of Wisconsin shows clearly that the account holder would be free from garnishment and the other creditor forms that could come
forward.
So it's
not considered an asset for those reasons.
Exactly.
As far as him. It's what the question, at least that I have, is that when he did invest on his wife and his grandchildren, these 529s, I guess there were five of them, that they were put in there, obviously, to because they are certainly the beneficiary has no power, but apparently the power that he has as the donor is not limited, and that's what I'm curious about it, because it would seem like a great, if this is illegal and it works out, it's a huge tax shelter. That this is a great way to, before filing bankruptcy, to liquidate your house. That's usually where the asset would be, and then protect that asset by putting them in 529s. And that's what where that's what your position is. That yes, you can do that, and it's legal.
Sure, and it's exactly what the legislature intended. The legislature created these accounts in order to further the education process. I mean, this is, as I've said before, this is a person of the greatest generation. He wanted to supply his grandchildren, and the statute was designed to create an exemption for him to encourage these kinds of transfers.
It's much better that his grandchildren benefit than the hospital debts and whatever else would be in bankruptcy.
It was given, this is the concept of a fresh start. Nothing was done to hinder or any indicia of fraud with respect to the creditors. This was pure exemption planning. There was no sharp practice here. And as a matter of fact, the trustee has never argued that. It is clearly an exemption designed to encourage persons to invest. And if they can do so pursuant to an exemption prior to a bankruptcy, there is nothing in the statute which precludes that. If the state legislature wanted to put a limitation on that, they certainly could have. Actually, the only thing we've seen from the state legislature is that they gave some rights to the beneficiaries under certain circumstances. The judge's argument in that particular case clearly then would preclude, or it seems to preclude, that being available to the account holder, which is the debtor. But there is nothing in the legislation which I say would preclude that.
The lower court's interpretation and the trustee's interpretation generates a redundancy in the statutes. If the 815 exemption covers only beneficiary withdrawals, then it duplicates what's in 16641, the former 1441. And that's an improper way to interpret statutes. Each one of them has to do some work. And the trustee's interpretation essentially makes one or the other superfluous.
I don't think it makes it superfluous at all. It was just designed to, in addition to the existing statute. The language in 1815.18.3p is plain and unambiguous. An interest in a college savings account under 16.641 is exempt. That provision creates an exemption for the account holder's interest in an Advest account.
It was enacted at the same time as the exemption for beneficiary withdrawals in 16.641.
Agreed.
So the legislature was providing two different kinds of exemptions, one for the account holder's interest and one for the beneficiary's withdrawals.
We agree.
One is not effective without the other. You know, you can't protect the beneficiary's right to withdraw from garnishment or exemption unless you protect the account holder's interest.
We agree. And also, there is a lot of language in here, but remember, this is a college savings plan. There are certain tuition expense plans which are also involved here, and which clearly there is a concern on the part that the beneficiary's interest gets protected. But it is clear that when Wisconsin enacted the college savings plan, when the state legislature enacted the college savings plan, the legislative history is key that they wanted to make sure that account holder, who is the debtor, his interests are protected, and they certainly provided for that. There was an addition to protect the beneficiary's interest, but that's not inconsistent with recognizing the exemption available to the account holder, which is the debtor in this case. And this was encouraged. The other issue in this case, which I'm anxious to get into, is the retirement annuity. This is fascinating because 815.18.3J provides that assets held or accounts payable under any retirement beneficiary, pension, disability, death benefit, stock bonus, profit sharing plan, annuity, IRA, et cetera, are all exempt where the benefits are provided by reason of age, illness, disability, or length of service. There is another provision here, which was enacted at a later time, which has to do with unmatured life insurance and annuities, and that's 815.3F. That provides an exemption for life insurance or annuity contracts owned by the debtor, as long as they're not over $150,000 in value. Then there was a provision that if it was issued less than 24 months before the date of the exemption, before the date of a bankruptcy, the exemption is limited to $4,000, and that's 815.18.2AM.
Did the annuity in this case comply with the IRS code?
Yes. Yes.
That was
determined. That was, and it's interesting because the legislative history really had to look at what was the Bogue and the Vanjin cases. When I was practicing before 2003, we put everything into...
My question was a factual one, not one of statutory interpretation. Has it been stipulated or is it undisputed in this case that the annuity for which the exemption was claimed complies with the IRS code for retirement annuities?
I can tell you that it did because that was contained in the annuity, but that was not stipulated to my knowledge.
That's one of the requirements for the exemption.
That is exactly correct.
So that wasn't litigated? I didn't see anything.
Nobody questioned the fact that it was exempt. It was assumed to be exempt under the Internal Revenue Service. The deferral was exempt under the Internal Revenue Service. It did qualify as an annuity in that respect.
Okay.
And
your time has expired. I'll better wrap it up.
Okay. Finally, Judge Hutchick was presented with the annuity on remand. He made a factual determination. There is no indication that the legislature intended to overturn the prior interpretation of 815.18.3J as concerns annuities, but rather envisioned that it was providing an additional exemption for certain unmatured assets. He then found very specifically that by the annuity's own terms, this court can only conclude that any distributions to Mr. Bronk are conditioned upon his age, illness, disability, or length of service under 815.83J, and
what part of the annuity supports that finding?
Pardon?
What language in the annuity
The annuity was presented on remand for him to review.
Right,
I've got it
right here. Tell me what part of this document supports that factual finding.
What part of the document?
Right. It's a contract. What part of
it
says
it is a contract.
This distributes based on age? I thought it distributes based on a date certain, which is 2035, when he'll be 100.
He went through the various indicia.
I'm asking a factual question. Right. What in the document supports the factual finding that the bankruptcy court made?
I can only say that Judge Hutchick looked at the annuity, determined that the annuity did qualify, the distributions were based on death, disability, and therefore he found as a factual matter that it qualified under 815 A3J. And not subject to the exemption.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Resup.
Good morning. We talk about this as a bankruptcy case, and this is a bankruptcy case, but this is just as relevant, if not more relevant, to the rights of creditors and the rights of debtors to protect assets in the state of Wisconsin. This exemption statute is allowed to be used by Wisconsin debtors who file bankruptcy because under Section 522 of the Bankruptcy Code, it allows states to have statutes that provide the exemptions. This is also the statute that applies to what judgment creditors can collect from debtors. The interesting distinction there is that the Bankruptcy Code also has a section, Section 541, that determines what is property of the estate. And the Bankruptcy Code says that if you buy a 529 plan, a college savings plan, more than 720 days before you file your bankruptcy case, it is not property of the estate.
What import does that have for the interpretation of the Wisconsin statute?
It has to do with the importance of how this case would apply in its decision. When it is decided
what
the exemption
is. We've got a question of statutory interpretation here under Wisconsin law. What the bankruptcy code says about 529s is irrelevant to that question.
I do think that it's relevant, though, to what the legislature intended when it enacted the exemptions.
We look at the language of the statute, so maybe you want to start there.
The language of the statute with regard to the EDVEST program under 529 refers you to a different statute. The language of the exemption statute in Wisconsin, 815.18, says that everything in this statute is exempt except as specifically provided in this section. And in that section, under sub P, it lists college savings accounts, and right before that, college tuition units. And it says tuition units purchased under 16.64, the entire tuition unit. Under sub P for college savings accounts at issue in this case, it says an interest in a college savings account under 16.641, which at the time of the filing of this case was 14.64. The legislature clarified that it wasn't the entire college savings account like it did with the tuition unit. It refers us back to those statutory sections. Timing is not important with regard to the exemption, to respond to your question you asked earlier, under the Wisconsin statute. It is only important if the debtor is in a bankruptcy case and whether or not that college saving plan becomes property of the estate.
Again, the bankruptcy code provisions have nothing to do with the question of state statutory interpretation here. And you've got a tough argument under the state statute, which unequivocally exempts an interest in a college savings account under 16.641. It doesn't say an exempt interest or an interest that is exempt under or an interest that is protected under. It just says any interest and interest in a college savings account. It's unquestionable, and as I understand it, not disputed, that the debtor here holds the account. So he has an interest in a college savings account because he owns it. So by the plain language of the statute, this account is exempt.
I believe that an appropriate reading of that statute is an interest that is provided to be exempt under 14.64.
But you're adding language to it.
The language is different than the language that was enacted at the same time immediately prior. And that was enacted at the same time.
You're referring to the tuition payment program.
I'm referring to the tuition payment program, and I'm referring to the exemption language in 14.63 and in 14.64 that were all enacted at the same time together.
Right, but the 815.18 provision doesn't merely duplicate an exemption that exists in 16.641. Otherwise, the two statutes do the same work. And that's, you know, violates a very well-established canon of statutory construction. Each statute has to be read to have some meaning. And if, as you argue, and as the district court and the bankruptcy court held, the exemption in 815.18p only provides an exemption for the beneficiary's withdrawal interest, expectancy interest in the withdrawals, then it does the same work as the subsection 7 in 16.641, and that can't be right. It must do something different.
Except that the execution statute needs to list the exemptions that are necessary to be applicable in the bankruptcy code. If it were only in section 14.64, I do not believe that it would be an allowed exemption underneath the bankruptcy code.
Well, it is in 815.18.
Yes, and I believe that to not apply statutes that are written differently in different ways is outside of statutory interpretation. The legislature
I'm not sure
would
what you're referring to. You're going to have to be more specific.
For tuition units,
not in the tuition units. We're in college savings accounts.
But the statutes were enacted at the same time. And when the legislature writes something different at the same time, it must mean something different. and it wrote that the entire unit was exempt. It
did
not write that.
For purposes 16641, but not for 81518. That's a different statute.
It did not write that the entire interest
in a college savings account. It said an interest in a college savings account. That's inclusive. It's not limited.
I believe that what that means is that the exemption that is allowed under 14.64 for college savings plans is the beneficiary's amount.
Okay, but that's not what the statute says.
I believe that is what the statute says.
You're going to have to explain to me why this language is ambiguous in order to get into the parallelism argument that you're trying to make here.
The statute
is ambiguous. So I don't see any ambiguity here. It says an interest in a college savings account is exempt. The debtor here has an interest because he's the account owner. That's very clear under the statutory scheme. There isn't any ambiguity that requires a resolution here by reference to the tuition credits program or any other canon of construction.
The ambiguity is that it provides more than would be allowed under statute that is specific to provide the exemption.
That's not an ambiguity.
I believe that is an ambiguity.
Why?
Because the
it covers a different interest. The specific statute covers the beneficiary's interest. The general statute covers the account owner's interest.
Why would the legislature put different words for the college saving units that have enormously different impact and benefit to the owner than the college savings
we
plan?
We don't ask that question unless there's
different.
Some ambiguity in the statute.
I believe there is ambiguity because when it says the interest under 14.64, what interest is that? And when you go to 14.64, it makes it clear that is the beneficiary's interest.
The exemption provision does. 16.641 provides that the debtor here is the account owner. The beneficiary's interest is residual, and it's an expectancy interest. All that 81518P does is say that an interest in a college savings account under 16641 is protected. The interest that it's referring to is the account owner's interest because that's what 16641 provides. Subsection 7 provides an additional exemption for the beneficiary's expectancy interest.
It doesn't
which was necessary because subsection P of 81518 doesn't.
But it doesn't provide an exemption. It provides.
That would be important if subsection P referred only to the exemption statute or the exemption provision of 16641. It doesn't. It exempts an interest in a college savings account.
Except that there is a specific provision that says exemption from garnishment, attachment, and execution.
I understand that. You're not grasping what I'm saying here, counsel. This general exemption doesn't incorporate only the specific exemption for the beneficiary's interest in 1641. The language just doesn't do that. It will not bear the reading that you're giving it. There also is no ambiguity in what it says. Right. And so there isn't any reason to get into what the legislature said about the tuition credit program unless there's a need to disambiguate the statute, and there really isn't here. The bankruptcy court and the district court and the trustee are searching for ambiguity where there is none.
I respectfully disagree with you, as did the lower courts in this matter.
Yeah, but this is a contested issue in Wisconsin bankruptcy courts. Other courts are going in different directions, so best to start with the language of the statute. And you haven't come up with any explanation for why 81518P is ambiguous on its face. And until you do, we don't get to these alternative arguments about how it ought to be interpreted.
The fact that you think it means something different than I think that it means.
That's not the test for ambiguity in Wisconsin law, no. You've misunderstood the test for ambiguity under Wisconsin law.
I would like to move to the annuity issue. In the annuity issue, the trustee appeals the allowance of the exemption from the cash certificate of deposit. The statute is that is used in this is subsection J under 815.18. And the question is, which statute applies? Section F, specifically entitled for life insurance and annuities, or subsection J, which relates to retirement benefits? I assert that the lower courts were incorrect and that this annuity is not appropriately placed within the category of retirement benefits. There was a recent decision issued by this case, by this court, in Ray Clark, in April of this year, that had the same discussion about whether or not an inherited annuity, an individual retirement account, retained its retirement benefit status such that it would remain exempt, whether under the federal statute or the state statute. But the argument was whether or not it was a retirement benefit. And the court found that it was not. And the court found that it was not a retirement benefit for the same reasons that I assert this is not a retirement benefit in this case. The money in this case was deposited into an account after the debtor retired. He's 74 years old. It is a contract to be paid out when the debtor is 100 years old.
But is it actually keyed to age? I thought it was keyed to a specific date.
It is keyed to a specific date. Judge Utchig's reasoning in the bankruptcy court about why it met the provisions of being on account of age was that there is a chart in the annuity that says if you withdraw at a certain age, you receive these dollar amounts. I respond that that is not by account of age. That's by account of a formula calculation about the time value of money from the date the contract is entered into and the amount and the terms of the contract for the benefit.
And that table applies post-maturity date, or does it also apply under the terms of the annuity to pre-maturity date withdrawals?
The debtor is allowed to make withdrawals at any time. It's just a matter of tax consequences about taxes that he will pay.
Okay.
Additionally, Judge Utchig found that it was by reason of death because the plan, the contract, the annuity contract, has a phrase in it called death benefit. It's still merely a contract for payment of money. It's not based upon death. It's not sponsor related. The annuity at issue in this case is more akin to the type of account that was in Ray Clark. It was not money, like in the inherited IRA, did not represent retirement funds.
Is it tax qualified?
It does not tax qualify as a retirement benefit.
Is that in the record?
I have not seen that in any of the briefs or in the record.
I didn't see any finding to that effect or discussion in either of the lower court's decisions, and that seems to me a critical omission.
I agree with you, and I, in addressing your question that you asked earlier regarding 815.18, it has a requirement under sub J that it must meet the following. Number one is that the plan or contract must meet one of the following requirements. The plan or contract complies with the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code. Well, what wouldn't? That is too broad to just say any contract would comply with it. In fact, in the federal exemption statute, it lists 401, 403, 408. You must be under one of those. It does not apply under any of those.
Yeah, tax-qualified retirement benefits.
And in the federal, similar federal exemption, it lists the tax, the Internal Revenue Code numbers, but does not in the state. However, it has to mean the retirement benefit provisions of the Internal Revenue Code because it is a subdivision under retirement benefits.
Okay, so here we do have a true statutory ambiguity because it's broad and vague, the requirement under J2A.
Yeah. And I think the legislative intent is clear in this ambiguity because the rest of the requirements are lengthy or paragraphs about employer-created plan, a trust under an employer plan, and then child support, which is not relevant to this case. But an owner-dominated plan has to be for or on behalf of an owner-employee. And the definitions, the lengthy definitions in this section, have to do with employer owner-dominated plan and owner-employee. And I think the most important legislative intent of this is the legislative history of after the Bogue case and other cases being decided on these annuities in 2003, a new statute was enacted, sub J, the statute that we believe would be the statute that this could be exempted under, where it's limited to $4,000 if it's invested within the first 2 years, which this one was. And at the same time in 2003, when the legislator added this statute, they also added a definition of annuity, a contract whereby the owner receives payments. And the legislative history cited in the brief says, we're doing this because our exemption statute doesn't address annuities of this type. It's not a retirement annuity such as a 403B plan. It is an annuity specifically addressed by the legislator in sub J and should be limited to the collection by judgment creditors and to exemption in bankruptcy court to $4,000 because it was within the 2 years.
Thanks to both counsel. Case will be taken under advisement.